Welcome to another deep dive, everybody. This time we're going to get into, healthcare systems.
This sounds exciting.
Yeah, I think so too. We've got some great materials for this one. A global health class from Queen's University in Canada. It looks like you're really interested in Module 6 healthcare systems.
Yep, me too.
I had a quick look through, and honestly, I was blown away by some of these different approaches. Like, Cuba has better health outcomes in some areas than the U.S., even with way fewer resources. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's a fascinating system.
And then there's this amazing program in British Columbia where the indigenous population is managing its own health care. So inspiring.
Yeah, that one's really innovative.
It just shows you how many different ways there are to tackle this. To help us figure it all out, we have, expert speaker joining us today.
Hey, everyone. It's true. Healthcare is one of those things that, you know, affects everyone, but we don't often stop to think about how different it could be, how other countries do things. I mean, that's what I think is so interesting about this deep dive.
Absolutely. So let's start with something I bet you've heard a lot about in your course, universal health coverage, or UHC. It seems pretty straightforward, but I'm guessing it's more complex than it sounds.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the goal of UHC, making sure everyone can get healthcare without going broke, that part's simple. But the details are where it gets tricky.
Oh, okay. So what kind of details?
Well, the World Health Organization, the WHO, they haven't actually defined what UHC looks like. Like, there's no strict definition.
Wait, really? I was reading that Queen's module, and they talk about UHC like it's a done deal, like a finished product, you know?
Well, it is, kind of. Most countries, that's their goal. It's what they're aiming for. But how they actually do it, how they put it into practice, well, that depends.
Depends on what?
Everything. Their history, their culture, their resources. What works for one country might not work for another. One size doesn't fit all.
That makes sense. So if there's no standard UHC, how can we even compare these systems?
Good question. That's where the researchers step in. They look at things like legislation. Does a country have laws guaranteeing health care for everyone? They also look at something called essential service coverage. They score countries based on how well they provide key services.
What kind of key services?
Things like maternal and child health, infectious disease care, chronic disease management, stuff like that. So even without a super clear definition from the WHO, we can still see how countries are putting UHC principles into practice.
Makes sense. Okay, but let's be practical for a second. Providing healthcare for everyone, that's got to be expensive. How do countries pay for all of this?
You're telling me. It's a huge job. There are four main ways to finance healthcare: employer-based insurance, private health insurance, state coverage, and social insurance. All have their ups and downs. It's like choosing a car, right? You get your sports cars, your sedans, SUVs, maybe even an electric car these days. They'll all get you where you need to go, but the ride's going to be different.
Uh-huh. Okay, I like that. So these different cars of healthcare financing, let's take a closer look. First, there's employer-based insurance.
Right. That's what they've got in the U.S. Your employer covers all or part of your health insurance. It's like a perk. You get this insurance as part of your compensation package. You get access to a lot of services, maybe even shorter wait times.
Sounds pretty good, actually. But I bet there's a downside.
Of course. What happens if you lose your job? You could lose your insurance, too. So now your health depends on whether you're employed or not. And then there's the whole issue of fairness. Bigger companies can afford great plans, but smaller ones might not be able to offer any insurance. So you end up with this two-tiered system.
That doesn't sound good, especially these days with job security being so shaky. Okay, what about private health insurance?
Think of that as like an extra. It's common in countries that already have universal health care, like Canada. That's like you've already got your basic coverage, but you want a little more. So you buy private insurance to see a specialist faster or to have more choice in doctors.
More choice is always good, but I guess it comes at a cost.
Yeah. It gives you more flexibility, but it can also make that two-tiered system even worse. People who can afford the extra insurance get better care, and those who can't might be stuck with limited options.
It's like anything. If you can afford it, you can get a better experience. So how about state coverage?
That's what people usually think of as public health care, like in Canada and the UK. The government directly funds and runs the whole thing using taxes. Everyone's covered, regardless of their job or income. It's like this safety net. Everyone's caught. Plus, the government can usually get lower prices for things like medications. More bang for your buck, you know.
Okay, sounds good. Everyone's covered. It's cheaper overall. What's the catch?
Well, you might have to wait longer for certain procedures, and you might not have as much choice in who you see. It's a trade-off, you know.
Yeah, there's always a trade-off. All right, last one. Social insurance. What's that all about?
Think of it like a big pot of money that everyone puts into, kind of like a group savings account for healthcare. You see this a lot in Europe, like Germany. Everyone chipped in. Employers, employees, and then this fund covers everyone's healthcare.
It's like a team effort.
Right. It's a mix of public and private financing, offering universal coverage, but still giving people some choices.
Sounds like a pretty good compromise, but I'm sure it's not as simple as it sounds.
You got it. Managing a system like that, it can be a headache. And how much each person contributes might depend on their income, which, you know, that could create some problems with fairness and quality of care.
So we've got all these different ways to fund healthcare, each with pros and cons. But let's bring it home, expert speaker. How does Canada stack up on the global stage?
Canada gets good grades for UHC, that's for sure. In fact, in 2017, Canada had the highest UHC index score in the world, 89 out of 100. That means we're doing a lot right, making sure everyone has access to basic healthcare without going broke. But, you know, no system is perfect.
89. That's incredible. I did notice in that Queen's material, there are some criticisms, like about mental health care and wait times.
Yeah, definitely areas we need to work on. Some say mental health services in Canada are underfunded and all over the place, leading to long waits for treatment. And even though universal access is great, sometimes the wait times for specialists for certain procedures, it can be a real problem.
Right. It's like we built this incredible house but forgot to put in some of the furniture.
Huh. That's a good way to put it. We've got a great foundation, but there are definitely areas that need more attention and resources.
Something else from that Queen's module that I thought was interesting is that Canada doesn't have like a clear definition of medically necessary care.
Oh, yeah. That can be a real issue.
It seems like that could cause a lot of confusion about what treatments should be covered, who decides, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. Without a clear definition, it can lead to disagreements between patients, doctors, and insurance companies. It can be really frustrating, especially if you're the patient trying to navigate the system, trying to figure out what you're entitled to.
Right. Has anyone listening ever run into this? Trying to figure out what's medically necessary? It can feel like you're trying to crack a code. Okay, so Canada's system has its strengths and weaknesses. But there's this other program in Canada that I found fascinating, the First Nations Health Authority. The FNHA in British Columbia. It's a model of Indigenous self-governance in healthcare. And I was just so impressed by what they're doing.
So the FNHA is a fantastic example of how healthcare can be different and successful when it's sensitive to culture and driven by the community. They're giving power back to Indigenous communities, letting them take control of their own health.
It's amazing. And their approach to funding is really unique, isn't it?
Yeah, they've got three funding blocks: protection, benefits, and support. So protection is all about primary care and public health, things like preventing diseases. Benefits are like extra things like transportation for medical appointments, mental health crisis help, dental, vision, prescription drugs, and support. Well, that's about strengthening the whole system, from staffing and facilities to transportation.
It's so refreshing to see a system that really gets it, you know? Healthcare isn't just about fixing you when you're sick. It's about all these other things that affect your well-being, especially in Indigenous communities where those social and cultural factors are so important.
You hit the nail on the head. The FNHA gets that. They're addressing the historical trauma, the inequalities, all the things that have led to health disparities for Indigenous people.
It's not just treating symptoms. It's about addressing root causes. And it seems to be working. The Queen's module mentioned that there's been a big jump in people getting vaccinated since the FNHA took over. Plus, more people in remote areas have access to services, and the overall wait times are shorter.
It's amazing what can happen when you let a community design its own healthcare system. The FNHA, they've made sure all their staff get cultural safety training. So when Indigenous patients go in, they feel respected. They feel understood. It's a great reminder that sometimes the best solutions come from those who are closest to the problem.
Okay, get this, because this is going to blow your mind. That Queen's module, it had a whole section on Cuba's healthcare system. And it's amazing. Despite limited resources and decades of a U.S. embargo, they've managed to do some incredible things.
Yeah, the Cuban healthcare system, it's fascinating. It really challenges a lot of assumptions about what's possible when you put health first, when you see it as a human right.
I'm all ears. Tell me everything.
Okay. One of the key things they do is focus on prevention, public health, keeping people healthy in the first place. They have these community health networks with doctors actually living and working right in the communities they serve.
I love that. It flips the traditional model on its head. Instead of waiting for people to get sick, they're trying to stop them from getting sick in the first place.
Exactly. And they've got this incredible doctor-to-patient ratio. more doctors per person than almost any other country in the world. So everyone has access to a primary care doctor, which is so important for catching things early.
This stat from the module is wild. Cuba has lower infant mortality rates than the U.S., lower. And their GDP, you know, how much money they have per person, is way lower. How do they do it?
It really shows what happens when healthcare is a priority. They invest a ton in prenatal and postnatal care, making sure mothers and babies get all the support they need. It proves that quality healthcare can make all the difference, even when you don't have a ton of money.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? So we've got this incredible system in Cuba, community-based, working wonders with limited resources. But could other developing countries do the same? Is it possible to take the Cuban model and just plop it down somewhere else?
Well, that's where the idea of South-South cooperation comes in. Developing countries can learn from each other, share what works, share resources, in a way that, frankly, often makes more sense than solutions coming from richer nations.
Right, because they face similar challenges. And speaking of sharing what works, the Queen's module talked about Cuba's program in Gambia.
Ah, yeah, that's a great example.
Yeah.
They sent Cuban doctors to Gambia to help them build their first public healthcare system. The documentary Salude, which is mentioned in the module, it really captured this whole effort. It was incredible to see these Cuban doctors embracing that community-based approach, working side by side with Gambian healthcare workers to improve access to care, especially in those rural areas.
I love that the documentary showed both the good and the bad, the ups and downs of this whole collaboration. It wasn't always perfect, but the Cuban doctors, their dedication and cultural sensitivity really shone through.
You're right. I mean, you're going to have cultural differences, misunderstandings. That's inevitable when you bring different cultures together. But it also showed how important it is to be flexible, to learn from each other. The Cuban doctors had to adapt, figure out how to make their approach work in the Gambian context, and the Gambian healthcare workers, they learned a lot from their Cuban colleagues.
Sounds like a great example of South-South cooperation in action, but can the Cuban model really work anywhere? Or is it specific to Cuba?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Hey? The Cuban model, it offers some great lessons. It's inspiring, but there are definitely challenges to think about.
Like what?
Well, one thing that came up in that Salude documentary, it's about the doctors themselves. Are they willing to make the sacrifices that come with working in a community-based system, especially when resources are limited? It's not always easy to convince doctors to work in remote areas or take lower salaries, especially when there are better-paying jobs in cities or private practice.
So it's not just about the system, it's about the people, having people who are dedicated to making it work. And what about governments? What role do they play?
Huge role. Without government support, especially in countries that are trying to build universal healthcare, it's almost impossible. But in a lot of developing countries, there's so much going on. Political instability, corruption, other priorities. It can be tough to stay focused on building a strong healthcare system.
Not to mention the influence of groups like the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank.
Right. They often have a lot of sway. And sometimes they push policies that lead to cuts in public spending, including healthcare. So even if a country wants to copy the Cuban model, these external factors can make it really tough.
So basically, copying the Cuban model isn't just copy and paste. You have to consider the context, the local situation, the political will, and you have to be committed to this idea that healthcare is a basic human right.
You got it.
But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I want to bring up one last point that really resonated with me from the Queen's module, that health is a fundamental human right.
It's a powerful idea.
It really is. It makes you rethink healthcare. What if everyone, no matter who they are, where they live, what they have, had the chance to be as healthy as possible, to live their best life, health-wise? That's what this is about.
It's about more than just fixing what's broken. It's about creating a world where everyone can thrive.
I was really struck by how the Queen's module talked about this. It's not just, you know, a nice sentiment. This principle, this idea of health as a human right, it's in international declarations and treaties, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights.
It's a recognized human right. It's not just talk.
Exactly. So if we truly believe this, that health is a human right, then it's up to all of us to make it happen, right? To make it a reality for everyone everywhere.
Absolutely.
It's a huge task, right?
Huge.
And it's not just about the healthcare systems themselves.
Right. We have to address the root causes of health problems. Things like poverty, discrimination, lack of education, and limited economic opportunities. All of these things affect how healthy people are,
yeah,
how well they live.
It's like trying to build a house on a shaky foundation, right?
Exactly.
No matter how strong the house is, if the ground underneath is weak, it's all going to come crashing down.
That's a perfect analogy. It's about creating a more just world, a fairer world, where everyone has a chance to be healthy, no matter where they come from, no matter their situation.
It's a big journey, right? And it's going to take everyone working together, coming up with new ideas, and being willing to shake things up a bit. We need to learn from each other, share what works, and support the people and programs that are making a difference. Speaking of learning from each other, that Queen's module also looks at how Canada's system compares to other developed countries.
It's a really interesting comparison. Canada often gets praised for its universal health care, but the module also points out where we could do better.
Like wait times, right?
Yeah, wait times are a big one.
Yeah.
Especially for specialists and elective procedures. I think a lot of Canadians have experienced that frustration firsthand, waiting months or even years for certain procedures. It's definitely a valid concern. The module compares Canada to other OECD countries, and we're lagging behind in terms of timely access to primary care and specialist appointments. Those delays can cause a lot of stress and anxiety for patients.
The module compared us to Germany, and it seems like they're doing much better with wait times, even though they spend less on healthcare overall. What's their secret?
Well, one thing is they have more doctors per person. So there were more doctors available to see patients, which helps shorten those wait times.
Makes sense. More doctors, shorter waits.
It highlights the importance of investing in our healthcare workforce here in Canada. We need to train more doctors and make sure we're keeping the experienced ones we already have.
It's like having enough cashiers at the grocery store, right?
Exactly. The lines move faster when you have enough staff.
The module also mentioned that Germany uses social insurance to fund their healthcare system. Like we talked about earlier, it's that shared fund that everyone contributes to. It seems to be working well for them.
It does seem to be a good balance between public and private funding. People have some choices and flexibility, but everyone is covered. It's definitely a model worth looking at, especially with healthcare costs rising and a population aging.
All right, we can't talk about healthcare systems without mentioning the United States. Their system is often criticized for being really expensive, complicated, and leaving millions of people without affordable coverage.
Yeah, the U.S. system is unique, that's for sure. They rely so heavily on private insurance, and there's not a lot of government regulation. It's a system that can be hard to access, hard to afford, and just a big headache to deal with overall.
The Queen's module talks about the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, which was an attempt to make things better. It did help millions of Americans get health insurance, but it's still a work in progress and a very controversial topic.
It shows just how complicated healthcare reform is, even in a wealthy country like the U.S. It's been really hard to achieve universal healthcare there, mainly because of political and ideological differences.
It raises an important question, though, doesn't it? What role should the government play in making sure people have access to healthcare? It's something to really think about, especially when we're looking at different healthcare models from around the world.
Absolutely. It's a question that goes deeper than politics. It's about what we value as a society. Do we value individual responsibility more, or is it about the well-being of everyone? There's no easy answer.
Let's come back to Canada for a minute. The Queen's module pointed out a specific problem in our system, and it's one that I'm really passionate about. Mental health care.
Yeah, mental health care in Canada, it often feels like there are two separate systems. If you've got the money to pay for private therapy, you can get help pretty quickly. But if you have to rely on the public system, the wait times can be agonizing. Months, even years sometimes.
It's awful to think about people who are struggling and can't get the help they need. And it's not just about long waits. The module mentioned that Canada spends a much smaller percentage of its healthcare budget on mental health compared to other developed countries.
Yeah, that's a big concern. The module actually cites a study that found about 70% of adults with mental illness started showing symptoms before they turned 20. That tells us how important early intervention is. If we don't catch these issues early, it can have big consequences down the road for the individual and for society as a whole. It's like ignoring a small crack in a bridge.
Oh, I see what you mean. If you don't fix it early, it can cause a much bigger problem later on.
Exactly.
So why aren't we investing more in mental health care, especially when early intervention can save us money down the line?
It's a good question. And a lot of mental health advocates have been asking you for years. The module actually quotes Michael Kirby, a retired Canadian senator who's been fighting for better mental health funding. He argues that investing in mental health now can actually save governments money later, because it prevents bigger, more expensive interventions down the road. It's about changing how we think about it, realizing that mental health is just as important as physical health.
Like that old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure.
Exactly. When we invest in mental health care, we're investing in our communities and our future.
The module also looked at Australia, which seems to be doing a better job with mental health care than Canada.
Yeah, their universal health care system, it covers more mental health services, things like specialized care in hospitals, community mental health services, and even places for people to live if they need more intensive support. And they have more government-funded programs and services that are specifically designed to coordinate care for people with mental health issues, recognizing that everyone's needs are different.
So Australia might be a good example for Canada to learn from as we try to improve our mental health system. What do you think, listener? Have you had any good or bad experiences with mental health care in Canada? We'd love to hear about it. Okay, let's shift gears for a minute and talk about another area where Canada's healthcare system gets criticized. Home and community care.
Right.
The Queen's module pointed out that even though home and community care is publicly funded in Canada, a lot of people still struggle to get the care they need.
It's true. More and more people need home and community care, especially as Canada's population ages. But our system seems to be falling behind, and that puts a lot of pressure on families and caregivers who often have to step in and do the work themselves, often at a big personal and financial cost.
That module had some really heartbreaking stories, like a CBC article about the home care crisis in Ontario, where families were waiting forever and often getting substandard care. It's just awful to think about people needing help with basic things like bathing, dressing, eating, and not being able to get the support they need.
It shows that even in a country that has universal health care, not everyone has equal access to essential services. It also shows how all the parts of the healthcare system are connected. When home and community care is lacking, it puts more pressure on hospitals and emergency rooms because people with chronic conditions or mobility issues end up there when they can't manage at home.
And as we talked about before, expert speaker, Canada's population is getting older. The demand for home and community care is only going to increase in the coming years.
Exactly. We need to start dealing with these issues now to make sure our healthcare system can handle the needs of an aging population. We need to invest in home and community care, train more workers, and be creative in finding new solutions to meet the growing need.
It's about understanding that healthcare isn't just about hospitals and doctors, right? It's also about helping people live as independently as possible, as comfortably as possible, in their own homes and communities.
I agree. It's about a holistic approach to healthcare, looking at the whole picture, from prevention and treatment to rehabilitation and long-term care.
Well, we've covered a lot in this deep dive already, from the incredible things they're doing in Cuba to the challenges that healthcare systems are facing all over the world, rich or poor. But before we wrap up, there's one more thing I want to talk about, something that's becoming more and more common these days. Medical tourism.
Medical tourism, definitely a growing trend. It is a growing phenomenon.
For people who maybe aren't familiar with the term, what exactly is medical tourism?
Well, basically, it's traveling to another country to get healthcare.
Interesting. But why would someone do that? I mean, don't they have healthcare in their own country?
Sometimes it's about cost. Certain procedures or treatments can be a lot cheaper in other countries, even when you consider the cost of travel.
That makes sense. Healthcare costs can be crazy expensive.
Yeah, for sure. Another reason is access. Maybe the treatment someone needs just isn't available where they live, or maybe the wait times are super long. By traveling to another country, they can get the care they need faster.
So it's about finding care that's affordable or accessible that they can't get at home.
Exactly. And sometimes medical tourism is about finding a specialist or a specific technology that might not be available in their own country.
It sounds like medical tourism can be a good option for some people, especially if they're facing barriers to healthcare. But I'm guessing there are some potential downsides too.
Oh, absolutely. It's important to be cautious with medical tourism. One concern is the quality of care. Not all healthcare facilities are the same, and standards can be different in different countries. You really need to do your research and make sure you're choosing a good provider with qualified medical professionals.
It's like booking a hotel in a foreign country.
Right.
You wouldn't just pick the cheapest one without reading reviews first. You want to make sure it's safe and clean.
Exactly. It's your health we're talking about.
Yeah.
You don't want to take any chances. Another thing to think about is the follow-up care. What happens if you have a complication after you come home? It can be tricky to coordinate care with your local doctors if you had a procedure done somewhere else.
That's a good point. And what about the ethics of medical tourism? Doesn't it seem a bit unfair if wealthy people can skip the line or get specialized care in other countries while other people are stuck waiting?
That's a great question, and it's a valid concern. Medical tourism can definitely contribute to health inequities. If it means that resources are being taken away from local healthcare systems, or if it creates a system where people who can afford to travel get better treatment.
It's like cutting in line at a theme park. You get to go on the ride faster, but it's not really fair to everyone else.
That's a good analogy. It's a complicated issue with no easy answers.
It definitely is. It's something to watch closely as the healthcare landscape keeps changing. Well, listener, we've talked about a lot in this deep dive. We've looked at different ways to pay for healthcare, compared systems from all over the world, and talked about some ethical questions about access, equity, and the role of government.
It's been a great conversation. I hope it's got people thinking about healthcare in new ways.
Me too. I always learn so much when we do these deep dives, and it's encouraging to see how much potential there is for making things better. Before we finish up, I want to come back to that question from the Queen's module. That really got me thinking. If health is a human right, how can we make sure everyone has access to the care they need, no matter who they are or what their circumstances are? It's a question that really sticks with me.
It's a question that should stay with all of us. It reminds us that healthcare isn't just about policies and systems. It's about people.
It's about making sure everyone has the chance to live a healthy life, a life where they can reach their full potential.
Absolutely.
A huge thank you to expert speaker for joining us today. And to you, listener, thank you for being part of this deep dive. We hope it's giving you a fresh perspective on the world of healthcare. It's complex, it's fascinating, and there's so much to learn. Keep asking questions, keep learning, and keep fighting for a world where health is a right, not a privilege. Until next time, stay curious.
It is a growing phenomenon.
For people who maybe aren't familiar with the term, what exactly is medical tourism?
Well, it's basically traveling to another country to get healthcare.
Interesting. But why would someone do that? I mean, don't they have healthcare in their own country?
There are a few reasons. Sometimes it's about cost. Some procedures or treatments can be a lot cheaper in other countries, even after you factor in travel expenses.
That makes sense. Healthcare costs can be crazy expensive.
Oh, yeah. For sure. Another reason is access. Maybe the treatment someone needs just isn't available where they live, or the wait times are just too long. By traveling to another country, they can get the care they need faster.
So it's about finding care that's affordable or accessible that they can't get at home.
Exactly. And sometimes it's about finding a specialist or a specific technology that might not be available in their own country.
It sounds like medical tourism can be a good option for some people, especially if they're facing barriers to healthcare. But I'm guessing there are some potential downsides too.
Oh, absolutely. It's important to be cautious with medical tourism. One concern is the quality of care. Not all healthcare facilities are the same, and standards can be different in different countries. You really need to do your research and make sure you're choosing a reputable provider, one with qualified medical professionals.
It's like booking a hotel in a foreign country, right? You wouldn't just pick the cheapest one without reading reviews first. You want to make sure it's safe and clean.
Exactly. It's your health we're talking about. You don't want to take any chances. Another thing to think about is the follow-up care. What happens if you have a complication after you come home? It can be tricky to coordinate care with your local doctors if you had a procedure done somewhere else.
That's a good point. And what about the ethics of medical tourism? Doesn't it seem a bit unfair if wealthy people can skip the line or get specialized care in other countries while other people are stuck waiting?
That's a great question, and it's a valid concern. Medical tourism can definitely contribute to health inequities if it means that resources are being taken away from local healthcare systems, or if it creates a system where people who can afford to travel get better treatment.
It's like cutting in line at a theme park. You get to go on the ride faster, but it's not really fair to everyone else.
That's a good analogy. It's a complicated issue with no easy answers.
It definitely is. It's something to watch closely as the healthcare landscape keeps changing.
Well, listener, we've talked about a lot in this deep dive. We've looked at different ways to pay for healthcare, compared systems from all over the world, and talked about some ethical questions about access, equity, and the role of government.
It's been a great conversation. I hope it's got people thinking about healthcare in new ways. Me too. I always learn so much when we do these deep dives, and it's encouraging to see how much potential there is for making things better. Before we finish up, I want to come back to that question from the Queen's module that really got me thinking. If health is a human right, how can we make sure everyone has access to the care they need, no matter who they are or what their circumstances are? It's a question that really sticks with me.
It's a question that should stay with all of us. It reminds us that healthcare isn't just about policies and systems, it's about people.
It's about making sure everyone has the chance to live a healthy life, a life where they can reach their full potential.
Absolutely.
A huge thank you to expert speaker for joining us today. And to you, listener, thank you for being part of this deep dive. We hope it's given you a fresh perspective on the world of healthcare. It's complex, it's fascinating, and there's so much to learn. Keep asking questions, keep learning, and keep fighting for a world where health is a right, not a privilege. Until next time, stay curious.